around the college room and they're here on the Wednesday though.
I muted it. Yes, now you can hear me. Okay, so again, thank you for the invitation and the opportunity. And I would like to hear from each one of you in the audience who you are and what your interests and priorities are here. So, yes? Please. And are you studying here? Are you faculty or?
No, I have a separate job here.
In what area?
With
Aris. Okay. Well, nice to meet you. And your last name is Energy or? Also renewable. Let's go. You don't need to stand up, please. Yes, I think we've met up on the mountains last time. CSR, okay. Okay. Nice to meet you. What is your, what are your interests? Okay. Okay. Yes. Okay. Okay. Professor Gyulos, you're on the faculty here. No, doctoral, excuse me. Postdoctoral or doctoral candidate. Okay. Yes. Sorry for the promotion. Yes. Okay. Well, I hope this also helps all of you, because you're from different disciplines, and the point here is to have an interdisciplinary discussion, engagement, and opportunity to connect and meet each other, too, that you are part of the same university, right? So, again, I met Professor Kaloudis in 2004, in December 2004, there was a sort of transatlantic collaboration meeting at Georgetown University, which is near my own in Washington, and he was there with Innovation. This was an Innovation Norway sponsored event. He was there, and since then we've done a lot of things. One of those is the co-founding of the Journal of the Knowledge Economy, which has now grown since 2010 into, I would like to say and believe, rather a mature, established, and growing successful journal. There's also the Journal of Knowledge Management, I recently became editor-in-chief of, which is an established journal with Emerald. Now the Journal of the Knowledge Economy is with Springer. And there is others like the Journal of Social Ecology and Sustainable Development with IGI, which may be of interest to some of you that are involved in renewable energy. And there's also the Journal of Innovation and Entrepreneurship, since this is an area I'm particularly interested in and focusing on. So here today, this is a presentation that has some, hopefully, food for thought regarding knowledge and what role it can play to promote advanced, accelerate, hopefully, even development. And this is an approach that aims to look at sort of beyond the immediate future. That's why Knowledge for Development Vision 2030 and a systems perspective. The underlying emphasis here is, as you will see, a systems approach. There is some text in some of the slides that I ask you to take a moment to read, and I will discuss going forward with you. Development, at least from my perspective, and hopefully those of others, is related to the openness, the degree of openness a society and an economy that is pursuing that development has. And that is an ongoing challenge, in fact, for both developed and developing or transitioning economies. Prosperity is not always going in parallel, hand in hand, with openness. And as we know, prosperity may be unequal. We may have the exacerbation, the worsening of divides, digital divides to begin with, but also social, cultural, economic, that emerge as a country develops. And this is a real challenge. Clearly, it's better to have fewer poor people, but it's not necessarily sufficient, satisfactory, or even sustainable to have more and more people that are well off, but at the same time, increasingly different and divergent socioeconomically groups of people that are also in proximity, awareness, and interaction with each other. That could be a very explosive mixture. We see that in countries that have been extremely successful in Asia, whether it's China or India. There's a recent article in The Economist about this, which I think is very important and interesting for you to read. Because in the end, what we deal with, whether it's energy or information, communication technologies, and the like, in the end, all this stuff has meaning to the extent that it betters human condition. So we need to be aware of the fact that 20 years ago, almost 2 billion people were living in extreme poverty, less than $2 a day. Now we have about 770 million people. A lot less, but way too many still. The other part that is also significant, and in fact, the World Bank has changed its mission. The World Bank remains one of the premier global development agencies. Its mission was to create a world free of poverty. Now it is to pursue sustainable prosperity. And that means to work with population groups, even in developed countries, that become newly impoverished. Now, let me now refer to and let me tell you a little bit about myself. The United States is my adopted country. Hello? My native country is the same as that of Aris and, Vasilis. That is Greece. Greece embarked on an effort to join other European countries as part of the European project, as we know. That has been not a very successful effort, and there is serious responsibilities both domestically concerning the country in question, but also concerning the authorities, institutions, and powers that be with the European Union and certainly other major countries in Europe, such as Germany. There is a process of gradual but persistent impoverishment going on in Greece right now. And this is not the only country, but it's a one I'm directly exposed to and aware of. You still have people that are very well off. So you have an exacerbation of divides. As a result, you have a polarization of politics. Democracy is under siege. And this is not just a challenge for Greece. Not to mention the refugees, which is another issue. These are all related, as you will see. Remember, this is a systems approach. I'm also leaving the slide there so you can read it. So, to have, as Aris mentioned, as the general priority is smart, meaning as effective and efficient as possible, sustainable and inclusive growth, means that you ensure that the poor of the world become less so and become fewer as much and as quickly as possible. At the same time, you make sure that those who are reasonably well off and have been so at a certain level of prosperity are not deprived of that. Sometimes it's much harder to get people to become used to less prosperity, having experienced it, than poor people to continue in their difficult conditions. Ethically, both are unacceptable states. So, be aware of the context, which means you're flying a plane with limited system support and very unstable equilibrium. Very limited degrees of freedom and room for error. So, having said that, there is room for opportunity and optimism, right? Whether it is in energy or other things. In fact, we are engaging, and next month I'm lead architect of a conference that is going to be hopefully first in a series taking place in Kuwait, looking at the Middle East and North Africa region, but involving partners and stakeholders from around the world, Europe, Asia, the U.S., focusing on smart growth. We have thematic areas that have to do with smart ICT, smart cities. The smart cities context, by the way, is very interesting because most people nowadays around the earth live in cities. The biggest part of the global population is urban. That's where you have the highest intensity of socioeconomic, sociopolitical, and sociotechnical interactions, and both challenges and opportunities are more intense. ICT, but also energy, another thematic area included in that conference, we're looking at is smart grids, smart energy grids, smart mobility, another area where both transportation but also energy is a factor, smart health. Smart health, smart education. We can overdo this with the word smart, but the point here is how do we develop more intelligent solutions that make better use of the technology, maximizing the benefits and minimizing the side effects, okay? Whether it's divides or other issues. So the Knowledge for Development Vision 2030 thinks of pilots. This is not just about grand principles or schemes. This is about pilots that have to do with, in a sense, the design and implementation of smart cities with an array of dimensions and components that have to do with smart ICT, smart energy, smart mobility, smart health, smart education, and so forth, and hopefully smart politics. So, the issue is, moreover, that these cities are not considered, could never be, never have been, and nowadays, more than ever, are not isolated. They're nodes in a network. So this concept of a global local, because there's local content, local relevance, and implications, but a global context is important. The real and virtual aspects are important too. Both of them come into play. They can mutually complement and reinforce each other, but they can also, of course, be misallocated, misengaged. The networking, of course, net-centric perspective is important as well. So how can we, I mean, we've been dealing with a lot of problems as the world has become more connected. So the idea is, and the opportunity, a challenge is how to make and derive more benefits from this connectedness, okay? Whether it's terror or disease or what have you, you have a lot of side effects from connectedness. The benefits may derive from and accrue from this concept that we call SCARCE. In fact, we have trademarked the acronym with a K, the word SCARCE in English, but written differently. Strategic knowledge, arbitrage, and serendipity effects that relate to the networks that we look at, social and socio-technical, in fact, networks, and where and how you can have these happy accidents, as we call them, that being part of a network That's why it's important to connect with each other and know who you are with, understand who you're with, not just know superficially, like all of you here, who you don't necessarily happen to know who you are. So connecting is important. And for that matter, technology, in that sense, can be a big problem. It creates a tunnel vision effect. It focuses you. Whether it is Facebook or Google or what have you, the search engines and the other such modalities that are ICT enabled profile you. They define you. Based on that, they optimize the search algorithms and the guidance they provide and the facilitation they give. In that sense, they push you direct in a certain direction, right? But we are not unidimensional, static, or rigid as human beings. We're creative and unpredictable. So the challenge is how to inject, introduce, and enable a higher level of intelligence that actually can accommodate that. In a social sense, social networks, traditionally in person, but also now to some extent complemented by virtual dimensions, really add value through these happy accidents, as I call them. Serendipity is the discovery in an unexpected manner of something you're looking for and you haven't. Should I lock the door? You haven't expected to find, but it can be useful to you. Okay? The arbitrage is interpreting that, figuring out where and how you can derive, extract knowledge from it. So really understanding and managing and leveraging these modalities and aspects of networks, whatever they may be, can help extract and capture significant value added from networks. And in fact, academically speaking, part of our research has been focusing on quantifying that, modeling that, developing a taxonomy of networks in terms of the potential to add value. So that's important. And the point here is that that's a way, an entry point for developing more connectivity and engaging society, for instance, social network applications that could work with the refugees in Europe or in general displaced people. I mentioned, and I include in this context, not just refugees seeking refuge, safe harbor from war and conflict and so forth, but also people who are socioeconomically and sociopolitically displaced internally within developed economies. So the issue is, how do we do that? Well, one important thing is to understand the nature and dynamics of this phenomena of serendipity and arbitrage. Understand how networks work. The other part is how to then develop capacity to learn. Understanding and leveraging this evolving topology and taxonomy that I mentioned of different networks is really very much centered on how you can benefit from that, how you can observe, understand, learn from that, and do so in a way that actually further develops your learning competencies. This is why the focus on higher order learning, which in fact has been the theme of my doctoral thesis, started 25 years ago and completed in 1994. These three levels of learning, how do they manifest themselves and how they interact and complement themselves? Okay, learning, learning to learn, and learning to learn how to learn. It sounds complicated. I'm not the only one saying that. I'm the one who has embedded this in a specific way in a systems perspective, not only in organizational and technological learning and knowledge management, but also in broader issues like development. So this is what we call Mode 3 knowledge production system architecture. Because in the end, what we're talking about, all this serendipity, arbitrage, and all that, it's about deriving, extracting knowledge from a given network, developing it and adapting it further, facilitating its adoption, absorption, and use, and reuse and development, right? So how you do that is enabled by these levels of learning and also takes place, is driven by these other three phenomena, processes that have to do with how stakeholders engage. We operate in a world of infinite desires and finite limited resources, whether it's energy, information, even though we consider it unlimited. The fact is that in a given time and space context and for a given set of conditions, information is not infinitely available. So it's a limited resource. So what you have is you collaborate and you compete at the same time. You have partnerships with stakeholders that in effect always have an intrinsic element of competition in them. It's naive to think or believe otherwise. There's a lot of talk, for instance, about open innovation. I think this is a misleading term. It's, in my opinion, a dangerous term. What you do have is what we call targeted open innovation, which has always been the case. Otherwise, it's almost like ignoring basic principles from game theory. Things like a prisoner's dilemma. You never disclose unconditionally in an unlimited manner everything you know. You share to get results, to hopefully get more benefit than the costs you incur through sharing, right? So there's targeted open innovation and there is competition. That competition actually changes you and those around you, right? As you compete, you co-evolve, whether you realize it or not, whether it has to do with the knowledge you possess, the experience you possess. You know, hopefully you will all go out of this room changed. I don't mean physically. And hopefully you will be improved for it. That's the point. That's the point of education. Is that a fire hazard? I locked you in? Okay. The idea is that, well, it's a good thing you cannot fire me, so, you know. Co-petition, co-evolution leads to figuring out under certain conditions for a period of time how you can optimally operate, right? Again, whether it's game theoretic or just the simple concept of sub-optimization, figuring out the best feasible configuration under which you can set up your profile as a stakeholder, agent, participant in a certain network, a certain reality, whether it's social, economic, or otherwise, leads to co-specialization. You and the others figure out what's the best role each one of you should adopt. So for a period of time, you can coexist, you can have a symbiosis that is optimal. All these things, I mean, you know, these analogies from biology, they do happen automatically in nature. We are, in a sense, and I don't want to go into deep ecology mindsets, but we are, in a sense, in some ways, regarding the environment. We'll come to that next. In a sense, maybe we represent a failed experiment of nature. We are Earth's problem. And this is not about whether we have climate change and all the other issues that some people actually contest. It's about truly what may happen. Nobody really knows the true nature of the nonlinearities involved in the evolution of not only the climate but the Earth as it is being impacted in response to the climate. I guess I didn't succeed in locking, did I? No, but this is... So, this is important, I believe. This is what that means topologically. What you see here, these little circles, are bundles of people, culture, and technology elements. This is a socio-technical thinking which says that you always need to take into account who is involved, what mindset they have and experiences and exposures and cultural biases and predilections, as well as what are the technological artifacts involved. Okay? And you can think of that at different levels, whether you think of micro, meso, macro levels, as we do in our research. So you look at firms, you look at sectors, you look at nations, and you can think also of that in terms of different ways these entities engage, collaborate, co-opete, co-evolve, co-specialize. Each one of these bundles, it's like, you know, think of Petri dishes. They're living entities, evolving, adapting, specializing, and then continuing to do so. They also have a life cycle, in a sense. They may die. They may mutate at some point. So you have multimodal, different ways, multi-level, multilateral, different aspects and different kinds of stakeholders and partnerships, and multi-nodal, of course, different nodes. How many of you know the game of Go? G-O. You know chess, right? Think of chess in three dimensions. This is an Asian invention. Does that remind you of this, perhaps? So, go now deeper in specific terms into how this multi-layered, multimodal, multinodal, and multilateral architecture and topology operates. You have, in its case, inputs, processes, outputs that relate to a given bundle. One of these bundles could be a venture, could be a company. Inputs are knowledge, the top of the apex of the pyramid here, or the triangle, technology and entrepreneurship, and of course, land, labor, capital. Now, who do these words remind you of? So, those of you from Professor Kaloudis' class who correctly answer this question in its entirety will get a perfect grade for the remainder of the course, right? This is what you agreed to? I am your witness. Who knows? No. The question is, who are the people associated with defining these inputs to economic activity over the years and the centuries? You do study economics here, right? Political economy, innovation, technological change. No? Nobody? Okay, so Adam Smith. Land, labor, and capital. You've heard of Adam Smith, the father of modern, to some extent, economics, the concept of supply and demand, elasticity curves, and so forth. You have Joseph Schumpeter, an economist from Austria, who wrote about the concept of technological chains. He wrote about creative destruction, how technology changes. In so doing, it disrupts and possibly destroys existing ways and orders of doing things and creates new possibilities. This is the essence of innovation. Knowledge. Peter Drucker, again, also a more recent. Smith was in the 18th century. Schumpeter, beginnings of the 20th century. Drucker, I think he still lives, I'm not sure, later part of the 20th century, also Austrian, and he wrote a lot about innovation, entrepreneurship, and knowledge management. These are inputs that go into a process that incorporates these dynamics of co-opetition, co-evolution, co-specialization, because these are scarce, limited resources, and you want to maximize the benefit from attracting and leveraging as much and as many of them as possible, in competition and collaboration with many others. The result, this bundle of people, culture, technology, which could be a startup, maybe becomes a company, maybe it succeeds to the extent this process is effective and efficient. This is going back to the thinking of smart growth and all the other things I've been discussing. It creates a firm that has both profit margins, scale and size, and all that, economic dimensions, but also, hopefully, creates spillovers, as we call them. Market, network, knowledge, spillover effects. It creates public and private goods and combinations thereof, hybrid goods. So then you benefit not only the immediate founders and stockholders of the company, but also stakeholders that may be related to it. You develop, through creating many of those, an ecosystem that actually can become a more robust society and economy. So, these, in essence, the knowledge and arbitrage effects manifesting themselves in the process I just described, are what we call real options. Now, financial options. Have you encountered these concepts? Puts and calls. The right but not obligation to buy or sell stock or some financial asset at a certain price. So then you sort of lock in the gains and you limit the losses. This is important, and the derivation of that is a real option. Doesn't relate, the option is always implying a right, right, to exercise, to buy, sell something, or create something. A real option is about creating a company, for instance, buying a machine, enrolling in a program. Financial derivatives, yes, this is another term. However, the derivation of derivatives was not from the financial markets, but from the commodities markets. Farmers to hedge, to limit their exposure against weather-related risk and changes in supply and demand, created a commodities exchange in Chicago first. The Chicago Board Options of Trade, and then, of course, you have had real options and shipping. Again, people involved with real, tangible products, whether it's pork bellies, as we call them, animals, or wheat, or other agricultural products, or shipping, cargo. The point there is that you say, okay, I agree. And you have a buyer and a seller and all that. There's an agreement that the pork bellies over a certain period of time in the future will buy the right to sell them, for instance, at a certain level. That means that if they become cheaper, that applies to oil, for example, and many other energy sources. Okay, what I'm talking about now is directly relevant, so we can cover part of that requirement for your energy course. This is very important. The commodities options trading, whether it's natural gas, oil, and what have you, is what helps, in effect, if you think about it, it what helps prevent wars from happening. Because you limit the exposure to risk and possibly substantial fluctuations and the impact of these fluctuations to the stakeholders of the global ecosystem of the economies of the world in the face of cartels like OPEC trying to influence the price fluctuation and trends of oil or other energy commodities. There is also instruments that help you hedge your exposure and or dependence, financially at least, to these changes. Of course, if a resource like oil or natural gas becomes limited by fiat, because the main supplier of that becomes, engages in a different kind of game, let's say, that is more geopolitical, that's then will have real impact, even though financially you may be somewhat covered. So real options are important. In this context, we think or consider serendipity and arbitrage effects are real option drivers in the context of entrepreneurship and innovation, because they really help determine whether, how and when a venture may be created and how successful it will be and so forth, how it will evolve. So the real option of creating a company and growing its success is the example here, or the case in point. Now, ICT plays an important role also in terms of how everybody becomes involved. The crowd, all of us. Crowdsourcing. Do you know these terms? Who can tell me what they are? What is crowdsourcing? Say? Well, okay, hold on. Actually, what you just referred to is crowdfunding. Crowdsourcing is learning from the crowd, possibly helping to determine and decide what to offer to seek crowdfunding. Crowdfunding, indeed, is creating an opportunity, and there are now emerging and increasingly important markets that leverage crowdfunding, which is pretty much what you said, providing opportunities to people primarily to give money to a certain cause, whether it is art or refugees or what have you. It's not exactly and so much. Now there are developments trying to enable that part too. It's not so much an investment. It's a civic or civil society engagement in support of a certain cause. That has been its primary derivation objective. But it has an investment possibility. Typically, crowdfunding does not involve exchange of equity or ownership of a company for funding, which can be small amounts. Coming, though, from many people can add up very quickly to a lot of money. In fact, the investment aspect of crowdfunding is reported to now have recently surpassed venture capital, which is significant. Okay, the other traditional risk capital investing modality. What is crowdstorming? Anybody? This is about taking over a city? Storming a castle or what? What? The Matthew effect. Is this from the Bible? What is this now? The Matthew effect. Tell me, I profess ignorance. What?
Florida.
Oh, that effect. Yes. You're talking about the weather. No, it's not about the weather. It's about brainstorming on a broader basis that still is more focused and structured compared to crowdsourcing. It's not an open-ended solicitation and invitation for input. It is a more focused, structured approach, perhaps reaching out to a community of interest or practice that is still bigger than a small focus groups, as traditionally has been the case, to do brainstorming. All of them are important and complementary, and this is about, as I said earlier, these initiatives and policies will be focused primarily, but not exclusively, at the places where most of the Earth's population is accumulating, namely cities, aiming to transform as many of these urban locales and as profoundly as possible into smart cities. Now, we come to the models. How do you do that? What do you need to take into account? What are the key categories of stakeholders that you aim to organize in the manner I have been describing? That relates to the models of quadruple and quintuple innovation helix. This is what that is. This is an evolution, development, I believe substantial transformation of the triple helix model, which has been around since the mid-90s. This model we developed, myself and colleagues, to incorporate and emphasize the role and presence and importance of civil society. So the triple helix looks at government, university, industry, policies, practices. This is sort of top-down. But if you think about it, there is a risk there. It ennobles autocracy. It ennobles insulation from the citizens. And that may lead to simply very wrong choices, decisions, and actions being taken over time. Now you can have, foolishness emerge both from the population at large, the citizens at large, because they vote in some crazy guy to be president, what have you. But you can also have, and typically you do, governments that are more autocratic and therefore more insulated from the broader crowdsourcing and such inputs, whether ICT-enabled or traditional. They don't listen to the broader desires and expectations and needs of the people. They believe they know what is good for the people. That can also be dangerous. In fact, historically, we know that. So the point is, we need to engage all of these sectors in a way that is as much balanced as possible, top-down and bottom-up. You need both. You need leadership. You can't have demagoguery. And this is, by the way, another challenge with the referenda approach, whether it is about the Brexit or the Grexit or any other such important decisions. In other words, remember, in the beginning of this presentation, I talked about making democracy safe for the world and the world safe for democracy. Democracy in the immediate sense, through referenda, for example, at least in theory, can work best, but it requires and assumes a rather mature, stable, and developed society and economy. If you have too many conflicting interests, divides, fear, greed, what have you, influence things, you can't expect people to choose wisely. They choose following their instincts and their fears. So you want leadership that compensates for that, and referenda are not always appropriate for everything. At the same time, top-down policies and practices should definitely be sensitive to and shaped by bottom-up grassroots movements coming out of civil society. And in the end, everybody should be aware of the fact that we are on the same planet. So, for instance, how many of you think that Germany's choice to end nuclear power in Germany, albeit they just moved the plants right across the border, is a wise one? This is about energy, right? Partly, right? So nuclear power is one option of energy generation, and continuing or not, again, real options, examples, creating a nuclear power plant, building a new one. Some say it's a clean, it's a green type of energy, some claim. Of course, that assumes and implies that then you can deal with the waste effectively, reliably, and in a manner that would not become an issue down the road a few thousand years from now. Right. Well, I mean, there is an effort to develop Mars. I mean, maybe, that could be. And by the way, I'm only half facetious. That could really become an issue or a solution, but there are always, technology is a double-edged sword, as we know. So this is an issue. Is nuclear power something that should become a thing of the past? Now Germany is using more coal. That is in more or less direct pollutant. What's the extent to which we can truly scale up and reliably involve in the sort of bigger context of an energy grid, renewable solutions? How do you determine and decide on that? So any thoughts from you guys that you're emerging experts in energy policy issues? Is it about scaling up, creating more and more wind farms, or is it about changing technology? Is it about changing the politics? Is it about changing the incentives and the economics? Is it about World Trade Organization issues, about protectionism or dumping of solar cells, for example, or other modalities of renewable grid implementation? So in a way, it's all of the above. Okay? What? So this is important. This mindset, again, at the center of it, you see smart growth. The implication being is that as you develop solutions, policies, and practices that take into account all of these dimensions as actively, in fact, proactively as possible. You don't just ignore something and wait to react to to the emergence of a problem because you have ignored it, whether it's the civil society or government priorities or whatever. You need to, it's a multi-criteria decision-making process that you need to sub-optimize on an ongoing basis. And again, I say sub-optimize because there's no ideal solution. The point is, what are the best possible but also feasible solutions? By the way, they say that politics is the art of the possible. And I have This is a definition I have developed and introduced in my project management classes. My definition of project management is constrained suboptimization of resource allocation. People sometimes, especially if they don't have an engineering background, become a little bit confused about this. I have 5 minutes, I know. Give me a minute to finish. So, again, I mentioned in this context the solutions, taking into account all these constraints. In effect, that means developing business models that work better and continually improving, engaging learning and other modalities, as we discussed. This means business model innovation. The better solutions have these three R's as I define them. Robust, resilient, and remunerative. They have to pay off. They have to be financially, socially, and environmentally sustainable. And they have to be robust and resilient, meaning they can just become unstable or counterproductive very easily. And again, the bundle, people, culture, technology, this is the context within which the business model innovation needs to be understood, defined, and implemented. Social innovation is very much a subset of these initiatives, and you know, let me just close with a couple more slides. At the macro level, I talked about open innovation being misleading and even dangerously so before, and I talked about targeted open innovation. In this context, you can think of this not only at the firm level, but also at the country level. And the more successful and innovative in a robust, resilient, and remunerative manner and a national innovation and entrepreneurship ecosystem becomes, the more the brand of the country, the national brand, becomes more powerful. It's a halo effect. It applies in marketing to a company. The same to a country, the same to a politician, by the way. But the point here is that innovation diplomacy, this is a concept, again, that I have recently written about, complements traditional forms of diplomacy, which is, you know, they say that war is diplomacy by other means, right? You can say that diplomacy is war by other means. We see that evolving today, unfortunately, concerning Syria, for example. Well, the point is, as a country, it is very important to enhance, support, and leverage fully the capacity of your people to become more innovative and more entrepreneurial, and do so in a manner that is reaching out beyond borders. They become your ambassadors. This innovation diplomacy concept is very important, especially for small countries. And you see that with small European countries that over time have developed mature and robust ecosystems that actually are punching way above their weight. Might actually apply to Norway as well. This is something that can still be considered or again built around focus on smart growth initiatives. So how do you develop and leverage innovation diplomacy, and more particularly, and this is the last slide, Aris, leveraging ICT in particular, the digital revolution. Modalities, opportunities, solutions that can be thought of in the context of the quadruple and quintuple helix. So you take into account top-down, bottom-up, government, university, industry, civil society, and environmental considerations. And, for example, you can serve a number of different areas of priority. I'm giving here as an example what I left, what I mentioned before and gave to you as food for thought. Food for thought, displaced people, social, economic, and political refugees. The more you help such people that may be part of your population or may be coming part of your population, the more your innovation diplomacy and your national brand becomes more powerful. So let me stop here. I don't want to go further. Thank you for your time. Questions? Yes. So, what is applied ethics? Applied ethics. What? No, I didn't ask you to describe to me. I'm asking you to define what is applied ethics in your mind. Yes. Does it mean then compromised ethics? I mean, how do you differentiate for more theoretical ethics? Is it applied more less consistent with moral principles? Is that what this is? Okay. So. Well, that's important to be clear about, so I can have your question now. What's your question? Yes, well, if you heard my comments, actually, I did talk about divides. You know, you have the biggest number of Rolls Royces in China than anywhere else in the world right now. You also still have, you know, after India, the largest population of highly impoverished people, the same country. You have effectively multiple countries that China has become, India and other countries, in a very intense trajectory of development. In a sense, up to a point, this is inevitable. What is important, more important perhaps, I mean, you know, over time, hopefully this will be mitigated. But what is more important is the residual effects of, for instance,